Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
Wer die Finanzen eines Unternehmens managt, ist oft beschäftigt. Sehr beschäftigt. Sehr, sehr, sehr beschäftigt. Konto ist das All-in-One-Geschäftskonto, um Ihr Unternehmen zu managen. Egal, ob Sie selbstständig sind oder die Finanzabteilung eines mittleren Unternehmens leiten. Mit Konto erledigen Sie alles in einer App. Geschäftskonto schnell eröffnet? Erledigt. Ausgabenmanagement? Erledigt. Buchhaltung und Reporting? Erledigt. Konto. Das Geschäftskonto, das zu Ihnen passt.
Wir alle wissen, dass Bewegung sehr wichtig ist. Für Selbstbewusstsein bis Achtsamkeit. Das ist der Grund, warum sich Elle und Nike auch für die dritte Staffel von Why I Move zusammengetan haben. Ein Podcast rund um das Thema Frauen, Wellness und natürlich Bewegung. Also gönnen Sie sich eine Pause, atmen Sie tief ein und hören Sie Why I Move.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. Coming to you live from London, I'm James Kamara-Sami. It is nearly a week since Israel announced a daily pause in military activity in part of southern Gaza to make it easier for aid trucks to enter the territory via the main Kerem Shalom crossing point. But that pause does not mean the fighting has stopped in other parts of the territory. In a week when disagreements between Israel's military and its government over the war against Hamas have become increasingly public. According to the International Committee of the Red Cross, 22 people were killed on Friday when what the aid agency described as heavy caliber projectiles hit an area where displaced people were sheltering near its office in Al-Mawasi, a coastal district on the edge of the southern Gazan city of Rafah. The Red Cross has not said who it believes was responsible. The Israeli military says the incident is under review. Families of the victims gathered outside a hospital in the town of Khan Yunis, among them Mona Ashour, who lost her husband.
We were inside our tent when a sand bomb exploded near the Red Cross tents. My husband went outside at the first explosion. Then a second bomb went off, even closer to the Red Cross door, and people began to gather. I tried to communicate with my husband, but was unable to. We fled as we were, in our clothes and barefoot. I tried again to communicate with my husband, but couldn't find him.
William Schomburg is head of the International Committee of the Red Cross's delegation in Gaza, and he spoke to me from its office in Al-Mawasi, where Friday's attack took place.
I mean, the scenes that we witnessed yesterday were tragic, horrific. I'm running out of adjectives to describe just how painful it was. There were several extremely loud explosions very close to where we are located. We are talking really just a few meters away from us. Several dead and wounded directly in front of our office, which was also partially damaged by the impact of these blasts. We were then able to transfer many of the casualties to the nearby Red Cross Field Hospital.
Just to confirm, were you there when it happened?
I was indeed.
And have you processed what happened?
I think after, you know, going on 9 months of war, it's an extremely difficult situation for anybody to process. I think particularly for our Palestinian colleagues and civilians within Gaza who have borne the brunt of this conflict, consistently having to deal with a lack of access to healthcare, very intensified hostilities, particularly around Rafah in recent weeks, as well as huge shortages in basic commodities. The burden of this conflict is too great for too many.
I mean, what does this do to your work? What, in a practical sense, first of all?
I mean, practically speaking, I mean, the International Red Cross, the ICRC, will do everything that we can to remain operational and to meet the humanitarian consequences of this conflict for civilians. We have had close calls in the past, and we cannot have more close calls. It is a question of life or death, and it is, frankly, a miracle that yesterday none of our staff were seriously harmed or injured. bearing in mind that next to our office, we have a camp for displaced colleagues in which we have dozens and dozens of staff living with their children and spouses who had to flee from the site and move on yet again after having been displaced several times prior. So, of course, we'll now need to think about what we can do for our teams to make sure that they can continue with our humanitarian mission. And we're doing everything that we can to ensure that staff safety and security is our main priority so that we can continue to run the hospital as well as the other programs that we have across the Gaza Strip.
Are you having to rethink the arrangements you have in place with the warring parties to ensure that this kind of attack on or near your offices doesn't happen?
Of course, you know, we want to bring attention to this situation because the safety of our team is at risk, and we do everything that we can to secure their security through dialogue with all parties to the conflict. And it's fundamental that for the International Red Cross, like any other humanitarian actor, we fundamentally need those security guarantees in order for us to deliver.
What sort of conversations, communications have you had since yesterday's incident?
The communications that the International Red Cross has with the parties to the conflict forms part of a bilateral and confidential dialogue. But of course, we do everything that we can, both at the level of our office here in Rafah, but also through our colleagues based inside of Israel, in Geneva, and in other major world capitals, where we are speaking as regularly as we can and ensuring that we try to engage and mobilize the parties and those who have influence over them so that we can continue doing our job.
Do you have any idea at this stage who was responsible for what happened yesterday?
Look, we're speaking about this today because it was a severe security incident after many close calls in the past and a tragic loss of civilian life. But what we are not here to do is to lay blame. And I think that we want to focus squarely on the outcome of this incident, to treat the wounded and to ensure to the extent possible that there will not be a repetition of such an incident in the future.
And just to be absolutely clear, this came completely out of the blue, did it? There was no sense of there was no warning. There was nothing that led you to believe that you needed to take shelter.
Nowhere is safe in Gaza at any moment. Throughout the day and night, we are constantly hearing crossfire explosions, other types of hostilities that often feel that they are within close proximity to us. So, of course, there is a level of risk that we try to the extent to mitigate by operating here because of how important the impact is of our work. But nevertheless, with this incident specifically, we had no prior understanding that something would occur as close to us as it did yesterday.
And as you said, victims were people, understand, who were sort of sheltering in tents nearby. They come to Red Cross facilities because they believe these are safer places. Is that going to change, do you think, as a result of this?
Look, we will continue wherever we can to provide services and support to those who are the most in need. But it is ultimately the responsibility of the parties to the conflict to ensure the protection of civilians under humanitarian law.
You have been clear and careful not to blame anyone for this. The Israeli military says it is reviewing the situation. But we do know in the past, Israel has accused Hamas of putting their operatives in amongst the civilian population. Have you seen any evidence of Hamas amongst those who are sheltering near your office?
What I know is that when I look out of my office, I see tents with families, with children in them, with mothers trying to cook meals using whatever they can find on the depleted local market, and dozens of my own staff members and their families who themselves have been displaced and live in, frankly, very tough conditions, trying to look after their loved ones while at the same time continuing their humanitarian mission with the Red Cross. That is what I see around me, Jason.
That was William Schomburg from the International Committee of the Red Cross speaking to me from Al-Mawasi in southern Gaza. Well, as the killing continues in Gaza, the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has warned that escalating hostilities along Israel's northern border with Lebanon could lead to a catastrophe for the region and beyond. The Iran-backed Lebanese group Hezbollah began firing missiles into Israel after the attacks of October the 7th in support of its Palestinian ally Hamas. Israel has responded by striking Hezbollah targets in Lebanon. And in recent days, the military activity and the rhetoric have become more intense. Our Middle East correspondent Lucy Williamson has been to the Israeli side of the border and she sent this report.
It's problem in here.
David Kamari's neighbours are long gone. The roofs of their houses smashed by shrapnel from Hezbollah rockets. David has stayed on in the largely deserted border town of Kiryat Shmona. Even now, weeks after a rocket hit his front garden, cracking his house in several places and filling it with rubble.
You were here?
I live here. This is my home.
And when the Katyusha came through?
I stand here.
He shows me the gaping holes where shrapnel sliced through the walls, missing him by inches.
You see the wall?
Yeah, that's the small one.
And big here.
The big one over there.
1 meter.
And points to the hills above us, where Hezbollah-controlled territory begins.
Every day, every night, bomb, problem. And I born here. Look, Hezbollah, kill Hezbollah. If you live here one night, you go crazy. Very, very strong, very problem. Bombs, rocket. Why?
Rockets hit Kiryat Shmona every week. One slipped past Israel's defences days ago, hitting a street outside the mayor's office.
And hit here.
Yeah, hit there and there and one there.
The US is pushing hard for a diplomatic solution here, but the mayor, Avichai Stern, says full-scale war is the only way out.
Sitting here like lambs to slaughter, just waiting for the day they attack us like we saw in the south, it's unacceptable. And everyone understands the choice is between war now or war later. I don't think there is any country in the world that would accept daily fire against its citizens.
Israeli strikes into southern Lebanon have displaced more than 90,000 people on the Lebanese side of the border. But some have stayed, saying it's better to die at home with dignity than be driven out of their land like the Palestinians. Fear of all-out war extends as far as the capital, Beirut, where some say they keep suitcases packed and passports ready in case full-scale war breaks out.
Of course we don't want to go to war with Israel, but if that's solidarity with the people in Gaza, so be it.
Of course, everyone is afraid, and those who tell you they are not are lying to themselves.
Hezbollah is a well-trained, well-armed military, backed by Iran. Its leader, Hassan Nasrallah, has threatened to invade Israel if full-scale war breaks out and says nowhere in the country will be spared. But Israel has been talking up its readiness to take them on. Tough talk is part of both sides' strategy of deterrence, but the line between deterrence and decision on a war is becoming harder to see. Israel's Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, is facing growing demands at home for a ceasefire in Gaza.
We want Hamas gone, we want the hostages gone, and we want to feel safe in our country.
That would help calm tensions in the north too. But Mr. Netanyahu is keeping both conflicts going, mortgaged by his promise to far-right government allies to destroy Hamas before ending the Gaza war. Playing for time is his specialty. But the longer this conflict goes on, the more it turns into playing with fire.
And that report was from our Middle East correspondent, Lucy Williamson. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. Coming up later on in the programme, Priyanka Gandhi, the daughter and granddaughter of assassinated Indian prime ministers, has said that she's seeking a seat in Parliament for the main opposition Congress Party. We'll ask a senior figure from that party whether this is just a continuation of old dynastic politics.
No one is forcing someone to occupy a place. We're going to the people. If the voters, in their collective wisdom, 2.5 million of them, elect an individual multiple times, we have to then give credit to the wisdom and the choice of the people. And Priyanka Gandhi, I can tell you, she campaigned relentlessly across the country. And if anyone should be in parliament, it's her.
The headlines at this hour, the leader of New Caledonia's independence movement has been charged over the deadly riots that swept the French Pacific Territory last month. And more energy infrastructure has been damaged in Ukraine in the latest overnight barrage of Russian strikes. We'll have more on that later on in the programme. You're listening to the BBC World Service. This is NewsHour, coming to you live from London with James Kamarasamy. The fashion designer Diane von Furstenberg once described herself as living a man's life, but in high heels. The wrap dress she created became a phenomenon in the 1970s, as women began to find their own style in the workplace. Well, 50 years on, a new documentary on Disney Plus called Diane von Furstenberg, Woman in Charge, examines the life of the designer credited with reinventing the dress. Our culture editor, Katie Razzle, has been to meet the woman known as DVF and the Oscar-winning director of the documentary about her.
DVF.
Fashion tycoon.
Influencer.
Feminist icon.
I did not know what I wanted to do. But I knew the kind of woman I wanted to be. I wanted to be a woman in charge.
Diane von Furstenberg was a female pioneer in the male-dominated business world.
Yes, I wanted to have a man's life, but I still wanted to be a woman.
A Jewish immigrant to America who became a chat show regular.
Welcome the woman who reinvented the dress.
For the famous wrap dress she created in the early 1970s. It's a stretchy V-neck, wrapped and tied around the waist, that is both flattering and office appropriate.
Jersey fabric molds your body, makes you look proper, but at the same time sexy.
The documentary's director, Charmin Obaid-Shinoy, agrees.
The wrap dress came at a time when high fashion wasn't accessible to everyone. So many women found it liberating. You know, don't spend so much time on all of this. Spend more time doing the things that you love to do.
There's a darker story influencing Diane's life. In the Disney Plus documentary, she reads out the letter her mother hurriedly wrote on a piece of cardboard and threw from the shuttered wagon of the train that took her to Auschwitz.
Mamika et toi, mon petit papa. Votre petite Lily va partir.
She wasn't supposed to survive, and she did survive, and she married my father, and they told him, you cannot have a child. So my birth was a triumph. My mother used to say, you are my torch of freedom.
Alors, où qu'elle soit, jamais elle ne sera seule, ni malheureuse.
My mother would never allow me to be afraid. If I was afraid of the dark, she locks me in the dark closet. Today, she could be arrested for that. But as a result, she taught me that fear is not an option. And the other thing is, never be a victim.
Charmin Obaid-Shinoy is already a double Oscar winner for her documentaries about women's struggles in Pakistan. She's now moved into the superhero universe. After acclaimed episodes of the TV show Ms. Marvel...
I can't believe it, Bruno. I actually have powers.
I've never seen powers like that.
She is directing the next, and still secret, Star Wars movie.
I've always wanted to tell stories of heroes. In my case, it just so happens that the hero's journey is always a woman.
Is it just so happens, or are you deliberately choosing
well,
that?
Well, I find my inspiration so much in the strength of women. I think that Diane's life is an anthem of freedom. And in the case of Star Wars, it's very much Daisy Ridley, but it's Daisy Ridley and... so many of the characters that we're bringing back into the Star Wars universe, and so many of the characters we're breathing new life into.
Diane von Furstenberg is a survivor who's overcome the threat of bankruptcy more than once, and in the early 90s enlisted the help of the shopping channel QVC.
Silk Assets by Diane von Furstenberg.
I think that I identify very much with what a modern woman.
The documentary starts with an arresting scene. A makeup-free Diane climbing into her bathroom basin to do her face in the mirror.
Yeah.
She doesn't hide the fact she is 77.
Aging is living. So if you have aged, it's already in the bank.
But in an industry that has been obsessed, is obsessed with youth, what's your answer to how to fix that?
I have never been that way. And maybe it has to do with my mother. My birth was a triumph of life. So every day I have to honour life.
The designer Diane von Furstenberg speaking to the BBC's culture editor Katie Razzle. Now, some good news from the natural world, because the Iberian lynx has clawed itself back from the edge of extinction thanks to conservation efforts. According to the International Union for Conservation of Nature, the lynx has gone from endangered to vulnerable on the global red list of species. A quarter of a century ago, there were fewer than 100 of the animals on the Iberian Peninsula. Last year, there were more than 2,000. Guillermo Zamora is a veterinary doctor who was part of the project Life Lynx Connect, which reintroduced the species of cat to Andalusia in southern Spain. And he began by describing the Iberian lynx.
The Iberian lynx is a medium-sized cat with a spotted fur, a short tail with a black tip, and very long beards and a powerful way of looking that if you lock eyes with an Iberian lynx, you will never forget.
I can see it. I can sense it in your voice. Why did they become so rare?
Well, they became so rare because they suffered high anthropogenic persecution during the 20th century. Most of the population vanished because of the direct persecution.
So when you say persecution, they were being hunted for what?
Well, at the beginning of the century, there was a powerful fur trade and they were killed for the fur. And moreover, there was a institutional persecution because already in the 19th century, the government paid for the extinction of all carnivores, that they were considered bad animals. And it went on in the 20th century and until 1959 or 60, the government paid for the people, for every lynx, not only lynx, all the predators, but we know that many lynx died in that program. And beyond that program, in the second half of the century, leghorns became very popular to hunt rabbits for selling in the markets, and many, many Iberian lynx died. Even after it was protected, many Iberian lynx continued to die in leghorns. It was the method of trapping them. And also in those areas where rabbit hunting was high, they became practicing what they know as predator control, using snares and leghorns and poison to kill predators. Well, Iberian lynx died because of that.
So how has the trend been reversed? What has been done to get the numbers back up again?
The trend has been reversed thanks to a comprehensive conservation program. In 2002, we thought the Iberian lynx is going to become extinct in 5-10 years. So the first action we did was implementing the captive breeding program to at least save some individuals if the population drive to the extinction. And after that, a multidisciplinary team began working in the wild population. And in the first stages, we had to work increasing rabbit density.
So introducing the rabbits was key. Is this now an irreversible trend, or are there still obstacles in the way? Are there potential pitfalls for the lynx?
In the current situation, the rabbit population will increase, and the only setback may be a new virus or other disease that can reduce the population in the future.
And that was Guillermo Zamora, veterinary doctor who helped to reintroduce the Iberian lynx on the Iberian Peninsula. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC World Service.
So
ServiceNow unterstützt ihre Business-Transformation mit der KI-Plattform. Alle reden über KI, aber die KI ist nur so leistungsfähig wie die Plattform, auf der sie aufbaut. Lassen Sie die KI arbeiten, für alle. Beseitigen Sie Reibung und Frustration Ihrer Mitarbeiter und nutzen Sie das volle Potenzial Ihrer Entwickler. Mit intelligenten Tools für Ihren Service, um Kunden zu begeistern. All das auf einer einzigen Plattform. Deshalb funktioniert die Welt mit ServiceNow. Mehr auf servicenow.de/AI4People.
Wir alle wissen, dass Bewegung sehr wichtig ist. Für Selbstbewusstsein bis Achtsamkeit. Das ist der Grund, warum sich Elle und Nike auch für die dritte Staffel von Why I Move zusammengetan haben. Ein Podcast rund um das Thema Frauen, Wellness und natürlich Bewegung. Also gönnen Sie sich eine Pause, atmen Sie tief ein und hören Sie Why I Move.
Welcome back to NewsHour. Coming up next, there has been another night of heavy bombing in Ukraine, with Russia again targeting the country's power infrastructure. We'll examine the impact that is having. And later on in the programme, we'll ask who should pay when debris from old space satellites plunges to Earth and damages property. First, though, campaigning begins today in Rwanda's presidential and parliamentary elections. Paul Kagame, who's ruled the country since the end of the 1994 genocide and has been president since 2000, is seeking a fourth term in office. Richard Kagoe is the BBC's Africa regional editor, and he told me about who's in the running for the top job.
The incumbent president, Paul Kagame, will be facing two other challenges. But he seems to be like a clear favorite, because if you look at previous elections, he's won with more than 90% of the vote. But looks like it's going to be majorly focusing on two issues: how you can be able to protect the country, considering the deteriorating relations between Rwanda and the Democratic Republic of Congo on its border there. And also issues to do with the economy will feature top on the agenda of the voters.
Two challengers, you say, but others who wanted to stand against Mr. Kagame have not been able to.
So we've had three presidential hopefuls who had expressed interest for the country's top seat. So notably is Victoire Ingabire, who's been a fierce critic of President Kagame, was serving a 15-year sentence that was pardoned in 2018. She was barred by the courts simply because the law says that if you've had previous conviction and you've been in jail for more than 6 months, then that disqualifies you. Diane Rugara, who's also an outspoken critic of President Kagame as well, was barred simply because she didn't produce enough evidence or documents to show that she had no previous criminal record. And Bernard Ntaganda as well, it was just the same case. So listening to the government spokesperson in Rwanda, because we put this question to her not so long ago, she said that this is literally the law. It's nothing to do with the government really stifling opposition or denying the incumbent formidable competition.
Now, when politicians get 90%+ of the votes, it's often calls into question just how free and fair they are. What are the kind of hopes going into this election?
If you speak to ordinary Rwandans, what they tell you is that if you look at the previous elections, for them, the outcome has been a reflection of their wishes, specifically because they've been rallying behind the incumbent because of his previous track record in terms of stabilizing the country and also turning it around in terms of the economy. The country has been ranked year in, year out as one of the top countries in terms of ease of doing business and also one of the fastest growing economies in the world. So those will be still some of the issues that they will be having lingering in their minds as they're contemplating who they're going to choose from the three candidates, including President Kagame.
And that was the BBC's Africa regional editor, Richard Kagoe, there giving us a briefing as Rwanda's election campaign kicks off. You're listening to the BBC World Service. This is NewsHour, coming to you live from London with James Kamarasamy. There has been a big Russian attack on Ukraine's power grid overnight. It's part of a sustained assault on Ukraine's energy infrastructure, which has led to a series of rolling blackouts in the country. Ukrainian officials say that two energy workers were taken to hospital in Zaporizhia in the south of the country, and equipment was also damaged in Lviv in western Ukraine. President Zelensky has said that half of Ukraine's electricity generating capacity has been destroyed since Russia began to target the energy infrastructure in late March. Well, Dr. Aura Sabadius is an energy expert at the Independent Commodity Intelligence Services and joins us now live on the line. Welcome to NewsHour.
Thank you.
How serious are these attacks on Ukraine's energy infrastructure, would you say?
It's very serious. This is the eighth massive attack on the energy infrastructure since March. And as you said in earlier in your presentation, this is more than half of the Ukrainian electricity capacity. And we're talking here not just generating capacity, power plants, but also transmission lines, substations, etc. So it's very serious. There are rolling blackouts and there are fears that Ukraine could see more blackouts than actual access to the electricity throughout the day.
So what can Ukraine do in response?
It's not, in fact, Ukraine. It's the West could provide more Patriot systems. Romania provided one earlier this week, but it's certainly not enough. And Ukraine needs a lot of air defenses because the more every time Ukrainian engineers repair power plants, the Russians will destroy them. So it's really futile if there are no air defenses. There's no way that they can repair and keep this capacity going.
Right. And what about storage? What is there?
Gas storage is in Ukraine has the largest storage capacity in Europe, and most of these storage facilities are located in the Lviv region, so it's western Ukraine. Interestingly, these storage facilities have been helping European companies and European consumers because throughout the years, many companies were injecting gas, were storing gas in Ukraine, and in winter they were using this gas as backup supplies and really guaranteeing security of supply to European consumers. Now, since these attacks started in March, most of these European companies have started to withdraw the gas from Ukraine because the risk is high. And that means that we have an additional security of supply risk in Europe this winter, potentially.
Yes, I was going to ask about winter. I mean, the initial kind of attacks on the infrastructure were at the beginning of winter. This is obviously happening in summer, but it's storing up problems for the months ahead, is it?
It is indeed. And my suspicion is that Russia is trying to put a lot of pressure on Ukraine to weaken it ahead of winter and to force it into some kind of negotiations.
Right. So that's the bigger picture then, is it?
But
on the ground, in terms of what this is going to mean for Ukrainians, we've seen, as you've said, these rolling blackouts. What can Ukrainians expect for the next few months?
Well, I suppose the whole country expects more air defenses because they understand full well that it's impossible to keep the capacity because Ukrainian engineers have put in a heroic fight to repair these facilities and to provide access to heating, to electricity, to water. But it's absolutely pointless if there are no air defenses to protect this infrastructure.
Dr. Aura Sabadius, energy expert at the Independent Commodity Intelligence Services. Thanks very much indeed. Now, in China's southwest Sichuan province, the long march to space began today for a rocket carrying a satellite jointly developed by China and France. The sound there of the Long March 2C rocket, that's its name, lifting off from the Xichang Satellite Launch Center. Well, the proliferation of objects in space, of course, means there's also a growing amount of space debris, some of which can fall to Earth and cause damage. Well, now a family in Florida is claiming more than $80,000 from NASA after a piece of space junk, which was part of a NASA flight support equipment, crashed into their house. Well, Jonathan O'Callaghan is a freelance space and science journalist and joins us now. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
How unusual is this, space debris falling into someone's house?
Yeah, this is a bit of an unprecedented situation. Space debris does fall to Earth fairly regularly. It's estimated maybe one piece a day comes back through our atmosphere, but most of this falls into the ocean or, you know, uninhabited land. So to actually hit someone's property, it is a bit unusual. We only have a handful of such events in history.
Is it normally then controlled? I mean, presumably it is if it's all going into oceans.
Yes. Yeah, so normally satellites are brought down in a controlled manner into points of the ocean that are, you know, uninhabited and won't cause damage to people. But occasionally you get pieces of space debris, such as in this incident, that, you know, are uncontrolled, are small pieces. This object here was a piece of battery pack from the International Space Station that just fell back through the atmosphere. NASA thought it would burn up as it came back through, and it managed to survive. So it's a bit unfortunate, but, you know, yeah, these things do happen occasionally.
Yes. And is NASA responsible then? I guess this case will determine that. But is, as you say, if it's unprecedented, we don't know how it's likely to pan out.
Yeah, it's a pretty fascinating case for space lawyers. But the laws in space are a bit sort of iffy. We have loose guidelines for when you should bring stuff back. And there are some liability and legal aspects if you do cause damage. A famous case of Canada suing the Soviet Union for $3 million back in the 1970s because they scattered debris over Canada. But, you know, having an individual or a family, like in this case, suing an agency, suing NASA for space debris, that hasn't really been done before. So, yeah, no one's really sure how it's going to play out. And yeah, it could have implications if, you know, we're going to see more of these events in the coming years.
Yeah, $80,000 doesn't sound like that much. I mean, I suppose it's the precedent that's the important thing for NASA.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, if space is becoming more and more busy as it is, and these events, you know, maybe they will happen more often. Maybe there will be more incidents like this in the future. NASA is kind of setting the stall here for what would happen in the future. You know, what if a private company, what if SpaceX with its thousands of Starlink satellites hit someone's property? What if, you know, China or Russia did the same thing? Yeah, or worse. You know, that's always a possibility. And, you know, this piece of debris fell through someone's roof, so, you know, very close to harming someone. So, yeah, that is always a worry with space debris.
One to watch. Jonathan, many thanks. Jonathan O'Callaghan there, freelance space and science journalist. Now, long before the Paris Climate Agreement, there was Kyoto. In 1997, almost every country signed up to a UN Protocol on Climate Change in that city, Japan's cultural capital. The Kyoto Protocol is widely seen as a point when politicians across the world woke up to the need to limit greenhouse gas emissions. Now, it's not the most obvious source for drama, but the Royal Shakespeare Company is staging a new play which tells a story of how that treaty was pushed through. Here's Vincent Dowd.
I refer you to sub-item 1B of the provisional agenda for the session contained in document FCCC.
In a dull grey building in 1997, dull grey diplomacy unfurls at a climate conference in Japan. 27 years later, Kyoto, the play, in rehearsal at the RSC in Stratford-upon-Avon, digs out the drama beneath.
We cannot force the problem, you did. China will never end war.
The authors believe how the argument on global warming has been conducted reflects the modern attitude to almost any big controversial issue.
I'm Joe Robertson, one of the writers of Kyoto at the Royal Shakespeare Company.
And I'm Joe Murphy, the other writer.
We're both very aware of the atmosphere in the world at the moment of disagreement, of conflict. There's quite a febrile sense of things, a feeling ever more entrenched in our own sort of isolated individual cells. And we came across this story about Kyoto, about the protocol agreed in 1997, actually on BBC Radio, mm-hmm. One of the reunion episodes. And it just seemed to us this utterly incredible, dramatic, moving story. And 176 countries came together and agreed on something that really they shouldn't have agreed on.
We'll recommend the adoption of this protocol to the conference by
unanimity.
Joe Robertson and Joe Murphy needed a central figure to hold together a story which could have become a morass of technical detail.
As we did more research, talked to dozens of people who were there, read as many books on climate as we could get our hands on, we sort of discovered a character who isn't in a lot of those books, but is often in the footnotes. There's not much online about him. And we did a deep dive into this man called Don Perlman, who was an American oil lobbyist during that time. He's deceased now, but he played such a vital role in those negotiations, in preventing the progress of the negotiations.
Don Perlman's played by American actor Stephen Kunkin.
Now, I know what people like you think of lawyers like me, but I'm the only one who can tell this story because I'm the only one who was there. And if you want to know it all, you can't have it all your own way.
Don is really the narrator in the center, telling a story of agreement through the one man who didn't want it to happen, presented to us an irresistible dramatic engine.
And the U.S. will not make itself war on the basis of a few scares.
Opposition in the Senate meant the US never ratified the agreement and Canada pulled out in 2011. Do actors Raj Rawi and Jurga Bosk think the script portrays anyone on stage as all hero or all villain?
No, I think what it does very specifically, it says, listen, you got to put yourself in the other man's shoe in this very divided world. But somehow they did reach an agreement, which was extraordinary.
We'll all use technology, we travel. Are you willing to stop having a car, having a phone?
How do you make 2.5 hours work on stage on this very complex topic?
A lot of energy, a lot of humour.
If you're so concerned, where's China's target timetable?
Where? We have 4 times more people.
The writers say their play is really about how, in a fractious world, we can find ways to debate the big questions if we try.
You really could point your finger at any issue in the newspapers or all across the media, such as gender identity, such as anything that we are discussing at the moment, and finding an appropriate and meaningful way to discuss. It is applicable to this.
Actually, how do you tell a hopeful story about climate change? How do you make people walk out of a theatre having felt something, having felt that change is possible, having actually been motivated by this incredible story? So there is a huge element of hope there.
Conference adjourned.
Climate change coming to the Royal Shakespeare Company. That report from the BBC's Vincent Dowd. You're listening to the BBC World Service, and this is NewsHour, coming to you live from London with James Kimarasamy. You're listening to the BBC World Service. This is NewsHour, coming to you live from London with James Kimarasamy. We learned this week that Priyanka Gandhi will become the latest member of India's most famous political dynasty to enter electoral politics. She will contest a by-election for one of the 2 seats won by her brother Rahul Gandhi in the recent parliamentary election, which saw his Indian National Congress party do rather better than expected. Not well enough to prevent Narendra Modi from continuing as Prime Minister, but forcing Mr. Modi's BJP to govern in coalition. Well, after shedding support in previous elections, Congress stood in this one as part of a multi-party coalition with the acronym INDIA. So what next for the party in opposition? Sachin Pilot was once its youngest member of parliament. He's now General Secretary of Congress. And he spoke to NewsHour when I was in India for the election. This week, Mr. Pilot was in London. And when he came into the NewsHour studio, I asked him whether he was surprised by the election result.
A little surprised because every exit poll in India was suggesting that the ruling party and its allies would get between 350 or 400 seats. And I knew that the reality was different. On the ground, we could sense that there is a palpable mood for change. And we saw that when the final numbers came out because we haven't formed the government, but the gap between the opposition and the ruling party has really narrowed down. I think the numbers tell a story that people are not happy with a single party government. That's why the mandate is fractured. How long and how strong the government will be, only time will tell. The parliament session starts next week. But the two allies without whom the government could not be formed will be keenly watched.
Of course, the opposition is also a coalition. And the reason you as a bloc got so many votes is because it's a big coalition and lots of those parties did very well. So is this the future for the Indian opposition? Is it going to be this broad-based coalition-style opposition?
You see, the opposition alliance was formed more than a year and a half ago. Most of them are regional parties, but the Congress, being the pivot of the alliance, I think has a greater responsibility for getting the opposition unity in place. And we've done that. It wasn't easy, I must tell you. A lot of give and take. The numbers today will tell you that the landscape has shifted. What happened in the last 5-7 years of this government would not be allowed to happen anymore, because in parliament there has to be proper debate and discussion and deliberation. So the opposition will remain united, and we've committed ourselves to doing that.
Is there not a danger in this model for Congress that in places where you stood back and let other parties be the figurehead of the alliance, your sort of brand becomes a bit in the background? So in those areas, for example, are you not in danger of actually losing the public's view of you as a party?
I think of these relationships as symbiotic. It's not transactional, and I certainly don't think that we should put our party's self-interest beyond the nation's interest. So we had to have made some compromises, which we have done. I don't think that'll stand in the way. We will still obviously make sure that our organization gets strengthened in the areas where we are weak. For example, in many states, we haven't done very well.
In terms of where the party goes from here, Rahul Gandhi, is he now cemented in as party leader?
He always has been, but we have an elected president, and he has the final authority on what goes on in the party. But he does consult Mrs. Sonia Gandhi and Rahul Gandhi, because they both have been party presidents. But Mr. Rahul Gandhi actually has done commendable work inside parliament and outside. He's walked 4,500 kilometers to send that message of unity, and that has really energized our cadres, and the results have shown that.
And of course, his sister, Priyanka Gandhi, is now standing for a seat. It doesn't do much that, though, does it, for the allegations of a dynasty and too dynastic a party to be dispersed when you have another Gandhi standing?
I think there's a difference. No one is forcing someone to occupy a place. We're going to the people. If the voters, in their collective wisdom, 2.5 million of them, elect an individual multiple times, we have to then give credit to the wisdom and the choice of the people. And Priyanka Gandhi, I can tell you, she campaigned relentlessly across the country. And if anyone should be in parliament, it's her. And I'm very happy.
Could she replace her brother then? Could she become the senior Gandhi in the party then?
Well, Mr. Rahul Gandhi has been MP for the last 20 years. That must count for something. And they work as a team. He has actually been the one who's taken on the Prime Minister and the BJP government head on, despite being, you know, put under all sorts of pressures, agencies investigating him. So he's faced all of that and yet did not give up on his conviction of what he believes in.
What kind of politics are we going to see in India now, given the fact the BJP has lost this sort of apparent iron grip it had on power? What does that mean for India in the next 5 years?
I think the people have spoken. They've said that you can't take us for granted. And to my mind, just having the right to vote does not define a democracy. A democracy is a state where you have watchdogs, you have oversight, you have a robust parliament, and you have independent, credible, transparent, functional constitutional bodies that people have faith in. What we'll see in the future, I don't know. This government has yet to start its work, but it will be carefully watched. We will be a very strong, an opposition that is not just critical for the sake of it.
Beyond those sort of institutional issues, what about the economic ones? Foreign investment has been dropping of late, hasn't it? Does that concern you?
It does, but I think it's just temporary. India has great potential. India has all the ingredients to become one of the top-ranking nations in the world. We already are the fourth or fifth largest economy, but we have to work on the per capita GDP growth, because the income disparities are becoming large, and we have to make sure that the tens of millions who are not in the economic mainstream are brought in. That's where we have some internal differences. But as a whole, as an export destination, as an investment destination, as a robust marketplace, we are very much there in the global framework, and we'll continue to be there.
Final thought on one of the main reasons it's thought why the BJP didn't do so well, and why your party did better than previously, is because the lower castes in particular felt they were being taken for granted and they weren't sharing in the economic growth. Does this lead to Indian politics becoming more caste-based again?
Well, the Indian political landscape is a very complex one. It'll be very, very simplistic to pinpoint one aspect of it. When you say that people were taken for granted. I know many people in the middle classes, in the urban areas, in so-called upper classes, who felt that things were not right. There was excesses done in terms of the brute force of the government of India being used to subjugate the voice of the opposition. And in two elected chief ministers being put in jail, the agencies working to quell the voice of the opposition. Any thinking person will not appreciate that. Indian voters, their depth of wisdom and intelligence, I think, is remarkable. They see how the politicians behave, what the government does and does not do, and then wisely, you know, give the mandate. So this mandate really, for me, signifies the far side of the people. So this caste reality, upper caste, lower caste, of course, it has some role to play, but I don't think it's definitive. It doesn't define Indian politics.
Sachin Pilot from the Indian National Congress, the main opposition party in India, ending this edition of NewsHour. From me, James Kumaraswamy, and the rest of the team, thanks very much for listening.
ServiceNow unterstützt Ihre Business-Transformation mit der KI-Plattform. Alle reden über KI, aber die KI ist nur so leistungsfähig wie die Plattform, auf der sie aufbaut. Lassen Sie die KI arbeiten, für alle. Beseitigen Sie Reibung und Frustration Ihrer Mitarbeiter und nutzen Sie das volle Potenzial Ihrer Entwickler. Mit intelligenten Tools für Ihren Service, um Kunden zu begeistern. All das auf einer einzigen Plattform. Deshalb funktioniert die Welt mit ServiceNow. Mehr auf servicenow.de/AI4People.
Wir alle wissen, dass Bewegung sehr wichtig ist. Für Selbstbewusstsein bis Achtsamkeit. Das ist der Grund, warum sich Elle und Nike auch für die dritte Staffel von Why I Move zusammengetan haben. Ein Podcast rund um das Thema Frauen, Wellness und natürlich Bewegung. Also gönnen Sie sich eine Pause, atmen Sie tief ein und hören Sie Why I Move.
Seventeen members of Zambia's national football squad have been killed in an air crash. The players were on their way to Senegal for a World Cup game.
When disaster struck Zambia's national football team in 1993, many thought that was the end of the country's international football dreams.
These guys had a desire to take us to the World Cup.
The whole country was mourning.
Instead, it was the beginning of one of sport's greatest comeback stories.
We have to go on. We can't give up. We don't give up in Zambia.
Amazing Sports Stories from the BBC World Service presents the four-part series, Copper Bullets. Listen now by searching for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.